want to see the world from a totally different perspective?
Ready for provocative conversation?
Intriguing stories?
And inspiration?
Then don't touch that dial.
Welcome
to Talk with Francesca.
She'll give you something to talk about all week long. Now, here's Francesca. What if you took the
time to really soak it? Hello. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Talk with Francesca. I'm Francesca Bastrash. You're listening to AM 1510 WWZN Revolution Boston. If you have any questions or comments and you want to join in on the conversation, please send me an email at host@talkwithfrancesca.com. You can also find me on Facebook, and my website is talkwithfrancesca.com. I love all your emails. I read them all, so please continue to tell me what's on your mind. I will answer yours. All right, today we're going to veer off a little on the usual track, just a bit, and talk about people who are, well, we'll just say into themselves. Do you know someone who's highly manipulative, charming, or grandiose? Maybe someone who lies pathologically, has no remorse, or exploits others? Well, oftentimes these creatures are naturally good-looking, intellectually curious, and financially successful. But what few people know is that he or she has left behind a trail of emotional destruction, having spent decades abusing vulnerable individuals for their own twisted purposes. Well, could this person be a psychopath? With me here now, live, loud, and local in the studio is Jim Silver, criminal attorney who has co-authored the book Almost a Psychopath. Welcome, Jim. Thanks for making the trip to the studio.
Oh, we appreciate your interest in the book, and we're happy to be here.
Okay, great. Why would you write a book about psychopaths?
The purpose of the book is really pretty simple. We think, and research backs this up, that there are psychopaths out there in the country. And there are people who we call almost psychopaths, who don't quite meet the clinical definition of a psychopath. They're out there. And what we wanted to do was educate people to the fact that there are some people in the world, maybe their neighbors, coworkers, somebody they're married to or dating, who operate by a different set of rules than the rest of us. And so we're trying to raise situational awareness so that readers, and I hope your listeners, can become a little bit more comfortable with the idea that they may have to come up with some different strategies to deal with these people.
And you're a criminal attorney.
I am. I used to be a federal prosecutor. I now do criminal defense work. Mm-hmm. And my co-author, Ron Schouten, is a forensic psychiatrist. He's an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School.
So you obviously see more psychopaths than the average person.
We do. I mean, I know I do. The estimate is basically accepted by most experts that about 1% of the general population are true psychopaths. And maybe 10% or so of the population are what we call almost psychopaths, or they're called sometimes called subclinical psychopaths.
Dangerous people, though, albeit, obviously.
They can be very dangerous. Certainly a person who's a true psychopath can literally be physically dangerous to you. But these are people who are psychopaths and almost psychopaths who are really in it in their lives just for themselves. They will use you, lie to you, manipulate you, and they don't feel bad about it. And so they can be very dangerous. Maybe they're only upsetting you. Maybe it's just something that's causing you angst in your life. But they can also be dangerous to your career and maybe even dangerous to you physically.
How do you spot one?
The one thing we really try to emphasize in the book is psychopaths and almost psychopaths are people who really lack empathy for other people, and they're very manipulative, very willing to con, very grandiose. However, we all know we all lie once in a while. We're all a little bit manipulative. So it's not one instance of being manipulative or one instance of being conning or even one instance of being violent that makes somebody a psychopath.
A lifestyle.
It's a pattern. It's how they operate. And what I like to think of with us people who are psychopaths is they don't choose to be manipulative. They don't choose to lie. They don't choose to be self-centered. That's just how they are.
They came out of the womb that way.
There's some debate about that. Some people think, there's some research to support the idea that psychopaths are born that way in some regards, that their brain, their neurophysiology is a little different than the average person.
Oh, really?
There are studies that show that they have a different brain structure in what's called their limbic system. And that's this part of your brain that deals with emotions and sort of empathy for other people. Mm-hmm. It seems to be different in some psychopaths. And the research is still ongoing. There's also a school of thought, though, that psychopaths can be more made, that it's more nurture.
Bad childhood, being abused.
Yes.
Being treated a certain way as a child.
Right. Maybe you're raised by somebody who has these psychopathic tendencies.
Narcissistic parents.
Absolutely. And you learn that's how you deal with the world. You take care of yourself first. First and foremost, that's the most important
thing. Numero uno, right?
Right. And everyone has some of that, but...
And some of that is healthy.
absolutely. There's absolutely no reason to think that somebody who's a little bit egocentric or a little bit narcissistic or is a little bit manipulative is necessarily a bad person. We expect that sometimes. If you want to sell cars, or I'm a lawyer, you want to be a lawyer, you're expected to do some of that. And so we accept it in certain contexts. It's people who can't turn it off, though, who cannot be any other way, who really cause a problem.
So give me 3 to 5 traits that would determine a psychopath,
sure,
or almost a psychopath.
Sure. These would be patterns that you'd see over time, but certainly a main one would be lack of empathy. A person who just doesn't seem to ever really feel bad about something that happens to you or other people. And you'll hear it in their conversations. Mm-hmm. They might say, I understand you said that you feel bad. Or I get that, I heard that. But you just tell they don't feel bad about it. People are also very manipulative, really willing to put themselves first, really willing to lie to you. And lying's a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
They will lie so much, especially true psychopaths, that after a while you might start doubting yourself. Because they're
make you
so
think
good.
Black is white.
Absolutely. And they're just going to lie and lie and lie. And if you don't understand that maybe this person can't stop lying, you really may start to question yourself. So the lack of empathy, the egocentricity, the lying, the manipulativeness, and just as a constant pattern over different parts of their lives, at work, at home, family.
Can it mess up someone who gets involved with a psychopath who actually has a sturdy foundation within themselves to begin with? So what I'm asking is, if you have a really good sense of yourself, strong self-esteem, but you get involved with a psychopath, do they have the ability to actually play with your mind?
Absolutely. That's one of the things we really want to focus on in the book, and we try and tell people is, be aware of what's going on. And if you think somebody's lying to you, maybe start asking around, check with other people. Do they have the same experience? If it's at work, let's say your coworker, Bob, wants to take credit for a project and says, that we're going to meet with the boss on Tuesday. And you write that down in your calendar. And then Bob sneaks in on Monday and meets with the boss and takes credit for everything. Well, check with other people. Did they write down Tuesday also? Or when Bob tells you, I told you it was Monday all along. Is he lying again? And it's important to remember, these people are so good at lying. Part of the characteristic of a psychopath or almost psychopath is a lack of empathy. And that means they really don't care what you think. They're not nervous about being caught lying because they don't care what you think.
What about when they are caught lying? How do they?
They will, generally speaking, just continue to lie. You can back them into a corner and they will just continue to lie. And what happens is, if you eventually find them out and say, I'm on to you, Bob. I know I can't trust you. You're a liar and I'm not going to believe you. Bob's going to move on to the next person. Bob's going to say, you're not useful to me anymore because you apparently don't believe me. So what? I'll find somebody who will.
So where do they lurk?
They are everywhere. we're talking
about
1% of the population, so that's 3 million people who are true psychopaths.
Mm-hmm.
If 10% of the population meet a definition we call almost psychopaths or subclinical psychopaths, if it's 10%, that's 30 million people.
That's a lot of crazy people running around.
Well, they're not necessarily...
Are they mad or bad? Or are they both?
They're
do you know what I'm saying?
Bad. Yeah, I do. They're not... they're hard to spot because a lot of times they are glib and charming, and they're nice at first. You'll be taken in by them. So these are people who could be anywhere. They could be in the cubicle next to you. They could be your neighbor. They could be a relative. You could be married to somebody like that.
What makes them this way?
Again, the idea is it's a nature and nurture. We think that research shows that some of it is probably genetic. They're born that way with a certain brain physiology that's a little bit different, and some of it's nurture, how they're brought up. And so somebody with that brain structure that's a little different, brought up in a loving household where they're just focused again and again and again on caring for other people, may turn out to be not a true psychopath, maybe not even an almost psychopath.
So if the parents, if they grow up in a prosperous, happy family, and their parents are normal, is there a chance still that a person can become a psychopath?
Absolutely. There's no real...
That's going to be really scary for the parents. Talk about feeling guilt.
It is.
Right?
It is. And some of it is... Some psychopaths seem to just be born that way. You look back in their past, their history, their youth, their childhood, and nothing stands out that would cause them to be so manipulative, so callous. And yet they are.
Okay. You're listening to Talk with Francesca, and I'm here with Jim Silver, author of Almost a Psychopath. Can children be psychopaths?
That's
obviously, I would think they probably could be. Right?
That's a great question. First thing to note is that psychiatrists don't like to label a child as a psychopath because it's such a powerful label.
It really is.
It's so stigmatizing. What they talk about with children is what they call callous and unemotional traits, which sounds a lot like psychopathy, and it is in a lot of ways. It's important to remember, too, of course, that children, up through their teen years, of course, and for those of your listeners who are parents know this, you know, teens are egocentric. They are self-centered. Some of that's normal.
Hormonally, they can be a little off. And
absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Mm. So it's hard to spot, but there are some children who appear to be beyond the norm in terms of their indifference to the feelings of other children, indifference to their parents, and act a little bit differently. And so psychiatrists do look at these children and try to identify maybe what we might call budding psychopaths or budding almost psychopaths.
You know, years ago, this was many, many years ago, an old friend of mine brought her son over to my home, and he was out playing with the other children, and he was killing a frog with a stick. I mean, like, really? And I thought, it really struck me. It sat with me. I thought, where did that behavior come from? What is that? And I just never forgot it. I don't know what came of that kid, but
isn't that interesting? That you feel empathy for that frog, and you feel it, and so you say to yourself,
yes.
Wow, how does that child not feel that? Of course, that's one instance. That may be an experiment to see what does happen if I hit a frog. How do I feel? Maybe he felt terrible, but if he didn't, and there's other instances like that in his childhood, that's a person who, you know, might be an almost psychopath or a psychopath.
What's the difference between being an almost psychopath or psychopath and borderline personality disorder? They seem like they would be sort of along the same path.
They can be. They're sometimes confused. I mean, they're difficult to separate sometimes. And that's one of the things we talk about in the book. We have a whole chapter on sort of a differential diagnosis. And it turns out that sometimes people might be diagnosed as borderline, when maybe it's psychopathy is a better diagnosis. There might also be some gender differences in how we diagnose things. Ron talks about this in the book. But it turns out that certain gender stereotypes come into play, and where a person, a mental health evaluator might say, this guy seems to be a psychopath, might look at the same type of behavior in a woman and say, maybe that's histrionic personality disorder, or maybe that's borderline. So they're kind of closely allied, but they are different, and it takes a careful analysis to figure out which is which.
And I guess realistically, doesn't really matter that much. The label in the end, you know, these are people who have big problems, who don't care about other people, are narcissistic. And so what does someone do if they realize that they're involved with a psychopath? Is it dangerous and difficult for them to get out of the relationship?
Well, that's a great point. You raised the first point about the labeling. The label doesn't really matter. And we say that in the book. We're not interested in labeling people as almost psychopaths or psychopaths. What we do say in the book, though, is it's important to remember, if you are dealing with somebody who's a psychopath or almost psychopath, they're really unlikely to change. And so strategies that you might use with other people, for example, going to a coworker and say, gee, that really didn't seem fair when you did that, or that hurt my feelings to a spouse, that's not going to work. You may have to try and set some parameters involving other people. Maybe it's a human resources department. Maybe it's a family counselor, and try and figure out some patterns of behavior that you can engage in that will limit your involvement with that person. You may also have to cut bait and run. It's important to remember, particularly with a person who's a psychopath, that if you're on their radar, you are going to be used by them and abused by them.
Is it more common for a man or a woman to be a psychopath?
It appears to be more common for men to be psychopaths.
I had a feeling.
Yes.
I'm not sure. Nothing personal.
No. I don't think people are going to be too surprised to hear that. Part of it may be that some of this is different diagnosis based on whether the person's a man or a female. But the research does appear to show that more men are psychopaths, although there's certainly women who are psychopaths also. For example, in prison, it appears that maybe 25 to 30% of prisoners would meet a definition of psychopathy. And maybe for women, it's more in the 10 to 20% range. So it's slightly lower, but still there.
Okay. How does a psychopath choose their victims?
Another great question. Part of it is just circumstances. If you're a coworker, you're liable to be a pawn.
Right place, the right time.
Right place, the right time.
Sort of right place, right time. Wrong place, wrong time.
Right, exactly. It's a bad place to be. They will also probably look for people, if they have to choose between two people to manipulate, a person who seems a little more trusting, a little nicer, and they use that against you. It's important to remember, you know,
the nice guy finishes last. Ouch.
Absolutely. You can be stepped on by these people just because you're a nice person. And we do try and emphasize in the book, don't feel bad if you've been tricked by these people. It probably means that you're a trusting, decent human, and you've been manipulated or conned by somebody who's very good at what they do.
You look for the good in people and
use it against them.
And use it against it. Okay. In closing, what is the best way to heal after you've been involved with a psychopath? I know that's kind of a question more for a psychologist, possibly, but you know, it just, I would think that it would do a decent amount of damage.
It certainly does. And we see it all the time in you know, in the families of victims. And certainly Ron's seen it in people's evaluated in their families and coworkers. You know, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. But I will say this. An important thing is to really try and say to yourself, it's not my fault. And there was a lot written about this, about not feeling guilty about it or feeling like you're a bad person, but recognizing that you've been used by somebody who's a master liar. And it's best to not try and blame yourself and just recognize it, though, so it doesn't happen again. There's millions of people out there who share these characteristics. The one you run into or the one you're thinking about now is not the last one you're going to see in your life.
Okay. Jim Silver, co-author of Almost a Psychopath, thank you so much for being on Talk with Francesca today.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
All right. Whitey Bulger. Does Whitey Bulger have any remorse whatsoever? Awaiting trial for his alleged role in 19 murders, the accused serial killer terrorized the streets of Boston. According to Dr. Stanton Seminow, a clinical psychologist from Alexandria, Virginia, he says murder is exciting, robbery is exhilarating, criminals commit crimes not because they come from underprivileged homes, take drugs, or watch a lot of violence on TV, but because they like to. When we come back, we'll be discussing this chilling view. Stay with me here.
Don't try so. Are you looking for a stronger or more creative business and internet presence? Call JB Web and Graphic Design. From websites and banners to logos and business cards, we'll help your organization or business to reach its maximum potential with style. Owner Johanna Bresnahan will work with you to ensure your complete satisfaction, and initial consultations are always free. So contact Johanna today at 978-998-5797 or visit her online at johannabresnahan.com. Once again, that's JB Web and Graphic Design at 978-998-5797. And remember, the better you look, the better we do.
Have you had enough of the same old cold cut sandwiches for lunch? Why not try something new and delicious? Punjab Cafe at 653 Southern Artery in Quincy offers an exotic Indian cuisine buffet special from 11:30 a.m. until 2:30 p.m. Take time out to relax and nourish yourself at lunchtime with daily lunch specials at Punjab Cafe, 653 Southern Artery in Quincy. Or call and order ahead of time at 617-472-4860. We also have many choices for dinner, so come on in. We are open 7 days a week. I know you'll come back again and again.
Are you looking for an authentic Italian meal in an intimate setting? Then you'll want to dine at Terra Mia's. This North End Italian restaurant provides a simply divine culinary experience and, as quoted in Zagat's restaurant guide, pastas without compare. And it's reasonably priced. This North End gem will keep you coming back. Terra Mia is simply the best Italian restaurant in all of Boston. Call 617-523-3112, 617-523-3112, or terramiarestaurante.com.
Have you ever thought about hiring an interior designer? No longer just for the upper class, designers offer many services that are affordable and involve clients making their own choices to achieve a high level of functionality, comfort, and style in your home. Christina Marie Interiors offers consultation and full-service interior design for projects ranging from residential to light commercial settings. At Christina Marie Interiors, we strive to create interiors that simultaneously elevate function and provide the client with endless inspiration. Our homes should be our refuge, our place to relax and recharge. At Christina Marie Interiors, we know that each client's needs are unique. CMI offers a range of services from paint consultation and selection to full-on renovations and project management. Give Christina Marie Interiors a call today at 781-572-5380 to start creating your oasis, or visit ChristinaMarieInteriors.com.
Basically, it was like going to school. I mean, I started out in crime, you know, in kindergarten, and went all the way to get my PhD. When I first heard it, it was disbelief that I didn't hear that right. And what happened was, when I finally, later in the week, went up to see Steve Flemmy in Plymouth, and he confirmed it to me, it was disgust, really. It was, you know, how could this be? you know, for 25 years. I'm out there doing your bidding. I'm right beside you on everything we're doing. And we went as far as killing other informants. And then I find out that they were informants.
So how? So you felt, did you feel sad? Were you mad? Did you want to hurt him?
No, I didn't want to hurt him. I mean, you know, anger. You know, at the time, I just wanted to basically, what I would have loved to do is just distance myself from the whole thing.
So were there ever times, that's what I wanted to ask you also, were there ever times in your career that you wished that you were not part of this and you could have just left? Yeah. Obviously, that was one of them.
Yeah, there was a time, I mean, when my first son was born, I wanted to get out of it, get away. And because I didn't want my my children being brought up in this environment.
Did your wife know that you were involved?
She knew I was involved with them. She didn't know to what extent. She believed I was involved in, you know, gambling, some loan shark, and I owned a few stores. So she wasn't, you know, privy to any of the serious crimes that we committed.
Why would a woman like that go after someone like Whitey, do you think?
Well, you know, the way he treated her. I mean, she...
How was that?
Well, he treated her well. And, you know, she probably...
What was well?
Well, I mean, they enjoy each other's company. They dine together. They go for walks together. I mean, just simple things. They enjoyed each other's company. And he's a different person away from business. I mean, how? Well, everyone can compartmentalize their life.
Yeah.
And so,
well, some people can more than others.
And he's one of these people that can.
And you can as well.
You can turn it off. I mean, you don't bring your work home with you. And she probably saw him in a different light, how he treated her, you know, how he was nice, attentive, and everything to her.
Was he loving to her?
I believe so.
So you think there's a side of him that actually has feelings?
Yeah.
But he's a sociopath.
Yeah, he is a sociopath.
Are you?
It depends on your definition of a sociopath.
What is your definition of a sociopath?
Well, I mean, I don't consider myself a sociopath because I've turned that off, that part of my life. You know, I mean, basically someone's a sociopath does things outside the norm of society and it doesn't bother them, you know.
So do you feel that what you did was the norm in society?
No, if it was normal in society, everyone would be doing it. It'd be you know, there will only probably be maybe 100 million people in the United States instead of 300 million. You know, you hear people all the time when they have arguments, I'm going to kill him, I'm going to kill this one, so.
Then do you think it was the LSD that, from what I understand, that he actually loved killing, as in when he killed, it was like a vacation? It was like he had just taken a two-week vacation?
Yeah, it was. I mean, when he killed someone, he was nice and relaxed afterwards.
Why would you think that was? I mean, that's kind of a peculiar way to go about getting relaxed, you know?
Well, it probably got out all his anger and stuff, you know? It's like a fighter going to the gym and hitting the heavy bag. When he comes out of the gym, he's kind of relaxed and spent. Same with him.
Was there a defining moment with Whitey when you knew there was just no turning back, that you were sort of, you were really in for the long haul? And if so, can you remember that day, sort of set the scene there?
Yeah, I mean, when I knew there was no turning back was when the murder of Brian Halloran and Michael Donahue. Now I'm involved in a double homicide, and I knew at that point there was no turning back.
There was no turning back. And did you at that time wish that you could have, that you had never gotten into it?
At that time, no. I really never thought of it. Years later, I did.
Your brother William has described, according to Wikipedia, the atmosphere in your childhood as follows. Smart was good. But having the ability to beat someone senseless, now that was real power. Education was often talked about in the apartment, but always with the implied threat that if your marks weren't acceptable, be ready to give up your soul to God because your ass belonged to our father, and A wasn't acceptable. Sounds like a brutal environment.
My father was a hard man. I mean, he was, you know, everyone says that, you know, it's a cliche, old school, but he was. I remember one time I came home with a report card. I had all A's and one B. And, you know, I got smacked around and I was on punishment for 2 weeks.
Wow. So do you think possibly that your childhood could have possibly shaped your choices in working with Whitey?
No, not really.
No. Was there any similarity between Whitey and your father?
No.
Also, in a chat with Boston.com many years ago, you say that staying along the straight and narrow is harder some days than others, like AA. Could you possibly ever be seduced back into that lifestyle again?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, you know, sometimes I'll be out and I'll be around and I'll see things and, you know, the average person doesn't recognize and I pick up right up on it.
Like what?
Oh, when people are doing things, when they're, you know, they're kind of shady.
Okay.
You know, and, you know, you see someone driving around in a nice car and they don't go to work and, you know, they throw money around and stuff. You know they're on the shady side.
And
you know?
So, and it's attractive to you?
Well, it's, I mean, it's attractive to relieve them of their money, yeah.
So, but why, you compared it to AA. So, why would that be? I mean, AA is like, Alcoholics Anonymous, so an addiction. So, do you feel that that was an addiction?
No, it's not an addiction. I mean, I miss, you know, in a sense, you miss the adrenaline rush and stuff. Mm-hmm. But the reason I equated it to it is because every day, you know, every morning, I go to work. I get up, I go to work, and, you know, I just promise myself I won't commit a crime today, you know, and that's how I feel, okay. You know.
So what was it like to go back into the world after prison? Did you expect to come back and after prison go right back into working in the mob?
No. I was too well known at that point. My face was all over TV and, you know, we had written another book, Brutal. Mm-hmm. And so basically crime wasn't an option at that point. Okay. I was too exposed.
So, okay, being too exposed is one reason not to, but if you weren't exposed, would that have been something that you would have wanted to go back to?
No. You know, it wasn't an option, and I wouldn't want to go back to it because the betrayal there.
Right.
So I really very cautious these days of who I trust.
All right. That was from an interview that I had last fall with Kevin Weeks. Joining me now is Dr. Stanton Samenow, a clinical psychologist in Alexandria, Virginia, and author of the book Inside the Criminal Mind. Thank you, and welcome, Dr. Samenow, for being on Talk with Francesca today.
Well, thank you very much.
For 12 years before he was caught, Whitey Bulger was prominently listed on the FBI 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list. What does a criminal really think of himself? Does he know he's bad?
Well, he's very purposeful in what he wants to do, and he is very methodical. He knows right from wrong. He knows the occupational hazards of crime, that he could get caught, convicted, confined, injured, or killed in a high-risk crime. But he has the remarkable capacity to shut this off long enough to do what he wants to do. It's really quite a remarkable quality. It's almost like shutting off a light switch. And so there's just enough fear that returns for him to look over his shoulder to execute the crime. So at the time he's committing it, he's not thinking about whether it's bad or good. It's what he wants to do at the time.
Why does he want to do it, though?
For the excitement, for the control, for the power to outsmart others, depending on what crime he's trying to perpetrate. If it's a financial crime, it's rarely about the money.
Really?
The money is just an index of how successful a crook you are. As we well know, there are so-called white-collar criminals who embezzle tons of money, but it isn't because they lack money. It isn't because they're impoverished. It's because they want to outsmart the system, outmaneuver others to show that they're more clever than the next guy. And how much money they get is just an index of how successful a crook you are. Obviously, you make a bigger haul if you get $200,000 than if you get $200,000. But it's not about the money. It's about the power, the control, and the excitement.
So is there a difference in the way of thinking for, let's say, a serial rapist versus a white-collar crook?
Not really.
Oh.
There are different MOs. In other words, people have their tastes and preferences in crime, and sometimes the guy who is the white-collar criminal would look down on somebody who uses force as crude, and he wouldn't do that. And conversely, the guy who might commit an assault or a rape might look down on the white-collar criminal as sissy, lame, or weak. But the fact of the matter is both of them have very similar thinking processes, and for both of them, whether it's the rape, the white-collar crime, or the burglary, it is, again, about power, control, excitement, a conquest, outmaneuvering, outsmarting others.
Do criminals ever have remorseful feelings for their utterly evil behavior?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because I remember a man that had broken into a elderly woman's home And when he found out after the fact that she was suffering from a terminal illness, he felt so conscience-stricken that he arranged to have all the belongings returned to her. However, that didn't stop him from breaking into other people's homes. So remorse can be experienced episodically, sometimes actually intensely, but it isn't a deterrent.
Okay. So you're saying that they do have some empathy?
Well, it's very shallow. It's very fleeting. And empathy, I wouldn't really use that term. It's feeling sorry after the fact. Of course, usually they're sorry that they got caught. But in the instance I just gave...
Right. Well, that's very different. Feeling sorry that you got caught is
very
different than feeling...
It's totally different from empathy. No, I would say if by empathy we're talking about putting oneself in the place of another person and even trying to anticipate how that person might react, trying to really put yourself in the other's place. Characteristically, they don't do that. All I'm saying is that there is a kind of sentimental, after-the-fact remorse. And I think with this particular guy that I mentioned, I think he thought fleetingly of if somebody had done this to his grandmother, how bad this would be. But as I say, even the remorse, if you want to call it that, in this instance, where he had everything returned, was not a deterrent to his committing other crimes of a similar nature.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Talk with Francesca, and I'm here with Dr. Stanton Samanow, who is a clinical psychologist and author of the book Inside the Criminal Mind. What is that rush that a criminal gets, that sort of exhilarating feeling? What is that about?
Well, let's put it this way. A man that I had interviewed who was 28 and was given a chance to be in a community program after committing a number of nonviolent crimes. And he was doing very well, money in the bank honestly earned. He had a job. His drug tests were negative. And one day, and he was seeing me for counseling, and one day he came in and he said to me, I thought if I stopped using drugs and living the life I was living, I'd have no problems. But I have more problems now than ever before. My truck breaks down, the partner I work with doesn't show up, customers complain, I have bills to pay, meetings to go to. If this is life, this is a heck of a life. And then he turned to me and said, what do you have to offer that compares with cocaine? Well, when he's asking me that, he doesn't mean just cocaine, but he means the whole way of life, the people, the places, the thrill of the deal, and so on. And when put like that, what am I going to tell him, that cleaning couches and going to probation meetings and paying bills compares to that kind of illicit excitement? And I said, if that's what you're talking about, no. I said, however, if you continue on the path you have, meaning working and putting money in the bank and doing what you're supposed to, you won't have to look over your shoulder for the people who will hold you accountable. People who care about you will start to trust you. You'll have a sense of feeling clean, and you'll go as far as your effort and talents take you, no guarantee of richer fames. And he went back to cocaine because this life, which requires effort at everything, effort in relationships, effort at work, effort even in sports, any activity, any human endeavor basically requires effort, doing things you don't want to do, not doing things you do want to do. That, for him, was like, as one person said, being a dog on a leash. Life has to have this, the oxygen of this guy's life and others like him is doing the forbidden, whatever the forbidden may be.
So at that point, did you realize that you obviously had nothing to offer this person? Because he seemed to be implicitly clear that this other lifestyle, life of a criminal, was far more interesting, and it was the way he
made it. Oh, that's right. And yes. He was more explicit than most because, you know, he could have tried to just feed me what he thought I wanted to hear and kind of go along that way. And when he raised that question and we had a discussion about it, it didn't take a degree in psychology to anticipate that he was going to leave the world of responsible functioning and go right back to that which he found to be, as I say, the oxygen of his life.
How did that make you feel as a clinical psychologist?
Well, listen, I've been interviewing, evaluating, and counseling offenders since the early 1970s. So I've been doing it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And although one wants to be able to help people, you do have to reach them at a time in their lives where they are vulnerable and amenable to being helped. So my self-esteem can't rise or fall based on the choices that these people make.
Right.
Obviously, I'm in this field to try to help people, but I understand there are going to be people that reject anything that I or anybody else has to offer. So that's part of the job.
Why did you get involved in this kind of work? What was the interest? What made you gravitate towards
this?
Well,
I met a psychiatrist at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, is still the home of John Hinckley, the would-be assassin of the late President Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And I met this psychiatrist who had been working very quietly for many years and started as a traditional mental health professional, thinking that criminals were victims and you needed to help them gain insight into their childhoods and why they were the way they were. And he changed his thinking and his approach totally. And so I became part of what was the longest in-depth research treatment study ever done in America of offenders. It went on for a total of 18 years. I was part of this study for 8 of those years. He died, the psychiatrist. I inherited the work. And as it is with many things, you don't know that you're interested until you gain knowledge and experience. So, in essence, I was learning a lot. I knew it was an important area socially, and it was certainly very challenging work.
A while back, I interviewed Kevin Weeks, who was Whitey Bulger's right-hand man. He had said that Whitey Bulger, after a killing, was very, very relaxed, as if he had just taken almost like a yoga class. His crime was like oxygen for him. Like, there was just this sense of peace, and he was, like, he had just, I think what he had said was he had just come back from vacation. Vacation, that's a very peculiar way to relax.
Oh, I've seen this. I interviewed a man who was charged with capital murder and actually was convicted of capital murder. And after he slaughtered and robbed two people he didn't even know, he just walked back into his mother's house and watched television and had a glass of Coke. Same thing.
So, but there, it sounds like it's doing something to help them to feel better in some way. I mean, when we think, normal people think about wanting to kind of relax, go on vacation, take a yoga class, as I said a few minutes ago, whatever it is that calms someone down, those are obviously healthy ways. But what is it about killing that makes someone feel? He was saying that Whitey Bulger felt relaxed after a killing.
Well, we've been talking about power, control, and excitement.
Right.
The greatest control you can utilize or exercise over somebody is to reduce that person to a quivering, pleading speck of humanity and snuff out his or her life. And having done that, there is a excitement at every stage, thinking about it, fantasizing it, excitement en route to the crime, excitement in the commission of the crime, and excitement in the getaway, and if there's publicity even then. So you have accomplished, if I may use that word, it's not a very good verb,
right.
What you wanted to accomplish. So there is a relaxation of
the job being done,
and the excitement,
yes.
And uh-huh. the uncertainty. Of course, at the time they commit the crime, they're pretty certain they're going to get away with it. And that, as you're calling it, relative quiescence, does not last for long, because in time it will be on to something else.
Of course. Well, I'd like to say something super intelligent, but all I can say is, wow, how sick is that? Are there any particular psychological patterns that a criminal has?
Well, there are thinking errors, and my focus is always been on thinking. Behavior is a result of the way we think. So my focus has been to try to understand the world from the offender's point of view, not to agree with the point of view, but to know what it is. And if you do that, then you see that they make certain errors in thinking, which many of us make, but they make them to an extreme degree. I gave one example earlier, and that is that most of us, for most of us, fear is a deterrent. I mean, you stop at a red light because you don't want to get a ticket, and you also don't want somebody to plow into you. You go get a dental checkup for fear that you might have cavities and you might have to have a lot of dental work if you neglect your mouth. So fear is an ally and a deterrent for people who are responsible. But for this type of person I'm talking about, to be afraid is to be, in their view, lame, sissy, weak. Those are words they use. And so they are going to show they are somebody rather than nothing. They are creatures of extreme. They think of themselves as number one or nothing. And any little detail of life that threatens that view of themselves as number one, it's almost like sticking a pin in a balloon. Their whole self-image can be on the line in the slightest thing. So you could have two people walking down the hall. One looks at the other the wrong way. You have a fight on your hands. So this is a person who will dish it out but will not take it. This is a person who deals with adversity either by making it worse or by creating it in the first place. This is an individual who really has no concept of injury to others at all. If you ask a guy who broke into somebody's house and robbed the place, well, who got hurt or how was the person affected, he'll say, oh, I know that the guy missed his stuff, but I've got to do the time. So there's no understanding, there's no appreciation of the ripple effect of injury, not only to the immediate victim, but others in the neighborhood and friends and family of the immediate victim. So there's a whole set of thinking patterns that are present to an extreme in which this person sees himself as the hub of the wheel around which everything revolves.
And it sounds like they're rather predictable in many respects.
The thinking is absolutely similar for every single one of them, regardless of race, ethnicity, level of education, or type of crime. You can't necessarily predict the crime per se or when they're going to strike, but the mentality is there with almost monotonous regularity.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Talk with Francesca. I'm talking to Dr. Stanton Samanow, a clinical psychologist and author of the book Inside the Criminal Mind. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, please email us at host@talkwithfrancesca.com. I actually have a question here. If we're watching a 24-hour film on a daily life of a criminal, how would you see the person reacting to disappointment or frustration? That question almost sounds like, you know, they would have big problems with accepting any type of responsibility
whatsoever. You
got it.
Well,
right?
Most of us know Murphy's Law, that if anything can go wrong, it will. And we deal with Murphy every day, sometimes in small ways, sometimes in larger ways. Mm-hmm. And usually we deal with things that go wrong. Okay, sometimes we could do better. In the life of a criminal, there is no room for Murphy of Murphy's Law. In other words, he or she, it can be a woman, offender, they have very unrealistic expectations of others and of themselves as well. So that if things do not go according to plan, they take it very personally. What do you think about road rage? Well, I'll tell you what I think it is. Road rage is an expression of this. For most of us, when we encounter a difficult or erratic driver, we may mutter under our breath, but generally we'll kind of hang back and get out of the way. Not the kind of person I'm talking about. He takes it very personally. It's about him. He's going to teach this driver a lesson, so he'll pull up alongside. He'll scream, curse, make gestures, and in the worst of circumstances, throw something at the car, or even try to force the car off the road. Mm-hmm. So any frustration, any disappointment, anything that does not support the view he has of himself, he is likely to retaliate sooner or later. So as you can imagine, since every day there are things for all of us that don't go the way we want, but for this type of person, he is always angry, but it's like a cancer that metastasizes. As one said, I don't get mad, I get even. So you get the one thing too much for this person who already is angry at things that aren't going his way, and then it's the driver or the person that gives him the dirty look or the person who makes the obscene gesture, and then you have his response.
I have actually quite a few questions coming in from our listeners right now. Carol from Linfield, Mass. Is this the upbringing? Is it their upbringing that makes them so, or is it a chemical imbalance?
The answer is, I wish I knew.
Yeah, okay. There
is nothing, and remember, I have been in this work since 1970, so it's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing that I know of in a person's upbringing that can explain this, and in fact, for nearly every offender that I've interviewed, no matter how adverse the circumstances he came from, he has a brother, a sister, neighbors that lived under the same or worse circumstances and had problems. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying the environment is irrelevant, but they chose to react differently. What has impressed me over all these years, and it never changes, is not the environment from which a person comes, but how he or she chooses to deal with life. Now, in terms of a chemical imbalance, we simply don't know.
Right.
There's an awful lot about personality and predisposition that we do not yet know.
But most inmates, they've been abused. I mean, so how do you explain that?
Well, they'll tell you they've been abused. First of all, most inmates are not honest. They will tell you they were abused when it wasn't true.
Okay.
Number two, there are people who are abused as kids through no fault of their own. But most of them don't grow up to be criminals.
Right.
And in fact, there are some who grow up to be model parents because they decide they are going to be totally opposite to the parent that abused them. And number three, there are many reactions to abuse, including self-blame, guilt, depression, and yes, there are people who may be angry. And furthermore, sometimes you have to say that cause and effect have been inverted. So if you have a child who defies every attempt for you to love, nurture, guide, and discipline him, and life turns into a series of power contests, and one day you just reach your rope's end, and you push him or slap him, and then have him turn around, and I've encountered this a number of times, I'm going to report you for child abuse, when the fact is that it's the youngster who's been the abuser and the parent is the one who's been abused.
Oh, my goodness. Here's a question. Andrea from Milford, Connecticut. Why would these unrepentant monsters put people through wood chippers? Well,
I mean, I think this is just another commentary on the never-ending doing what nobody else would do. You remember Jeffrey Dahmer, who was the man that killed young men and chopped up the body and allegedly cannibalize them. So when I said there's excitement in every stage what others wouldn't do, it sounds sick to us, but these acts are the product of deliberate, rational, and calculating minds.
Wow. John from Plymouth wants to know, why are drugs usually part of a crime?
Well, for many people who commit crimes, drugs help knock out fear. I remember the man who said, I had thought about holding up a liquor store with a gun, but I was always too afraid to do it. But drugs knocked off my caution. Mm-hmm. On drugs, he was not as troubled by thoughts of consequences. Drugs made crimes easier for him to commit. I mean, that's one aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Mark,
we could talk about that one for quite a while.
Right. I know we just have a few minutes left, but Mark from Marblehead would like to know if killing is an addiction.
I would not use that term. Certainly there are people who kill and are serial killers, but they are not in the grips of something over which they have no control.
Mm-hmm.
Their acts are calculated. They are rational. They are the product of a rational mind. And, I mean, I know there are cases that are where there are trials for not guilty by reason of insanity. So I'm talking about, for the most part, and that's a separate category. So, no, I would not agree that it is an addiction.
Okay, we have another question coming through here. Cheryl from Saugus wants to know if rehab is just a fantasy.
If what?
If rehab is just a fantasy.
I think for many offenders, I said earlier, they will reject anything that they are offered, and yet there are some people that if you reach them at a time where they are vulnerable, and if you want to expend and have the resources to expend, there are some, albeit a minority, who can change. But what must change is basic thinking patterns, not just job skills or social skills or GEDs. Thinking is critical. So I'm still writing about that. I'm still working with some offenders under certain conditions. But by and large, the people that are extreme, yes, the utilization of valuable resources is not going to be well expended in trying to reach these people.
Eric from Connecticut, why do these types have no respect for life? Well, I think we've kind of answered that, I would say. And let's see.
They're simply not thinking of people as human beings.
Right. And we also have Joy from Madison, Connecticut. Is there something during childhood that makes someone a criminal? I think you answered that also.
You know, unfortunately, and the questions are very good, both yours and the questions you're receiving, but unfortunately, I have an appointment out of the office, and I am going to have to stop.
Yes, no problem. And thank you, Dr. Stamenow, so much for your time. Very, very helpful. Do we have a website that people can go to?
Yes, certainly. And it's just www.stamenow, S-A-M as in Mary, E, N as in Nancy, O-W.com. And there's my website and my email. You can email me with any questions. And it's Stamenow, S-A-M-E-N-O-W, at Cox, C-O-X, .net.
Fantastic.
And I always answer emails.
Great. Thanks so much for being on Talk with Francesca today.
Well, thank you, and the interview was great.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we're about to wrap things up. If you want to know more about what's ahead on Talk with Francesca, visit my website, talkwithfrancesca.com, and click on upcoming shows. And, of course, if you miss some of the show today, it'll be posted on my website. It always is. You don't have to wait till next week to contact me. You can send me an email at host@talkwithfrancesca.com, or you can visit me on Facebook at Talk with Francesca. Thanks for tuning in. Have a fantastic week. And, as always, I hope I gave you something to talk about. Enjoy the weekend.
Don't try so.
Are you looking for a stronger or more creative business and internet presence? Call JB Web and Graphic Design. From websites and banners to logos and business cards, we'll help your organization or business to reach its maximum potential with style. Owner Johanna Bresnahan will work with you to ensure your complete satisfaction, and initial consultations are always free. So contact Johanna today at 978-998-5797 or visit her online at johannabresnahan.com. Once again, that's JB Web and Graphic Design at 978-998-5797. And remember, the better you look, the better we do.
Have you had enough of the same old cold cut sandwiches for lunch? Why not try something new and delicious? Punjab Cafe at 653 Southern Artery in Quincy offers an exotic Indian cuisine buffet special from 11:30 a.m. until 2:30 p.m. Take time out to relax and nourish yourself at lunchtime with daily lunch specials at Punjab Cafe, 653 Southern Artery in Quincy. Or call and order ahead of time at 617-472-4860. We also have many choices for dinner, so come on in. We are open 7 days a week. I know you'll come back again and again.